I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Is hair a material?
Are biscuits a material?
Are crystals a material?
Is plastic a material?
Is porridge a material?
Can gases be a material?
Are eggs a material?
Is water a material?
What do you call everything that isn't a material?
Sorry, I didn't mean to laugh at you. I'm going to do it.
And yet you continue to do so.
Hello, and welcome back to Handmade, the making podcast with real talk about materials. I'm your host, material scientist Anna Pajewski, and this episode I talk to artist and designer Frances Priest about her work with ceramics. I started by asking Frances the story of how she became an artist.
Well, I grew up in Wakefield in West Yorkshire, and I don't come from like a background of kind of artists or craftspeople, but I guess my upbringing was, surrounded by making of different sorts, because my mum would make clothes and she would embroider, and both my parents are keen gardeners, and my dad would fix the car and take on DIY projects. So I guess that was kind of the background to just daily life. And I was always drawing, really. That was, kind of one of my favourite activities, or out in the garden making mud pies.
Brilliant.
So heading off to art college was maybe quite a left of field decision. And I started off on a foundation course at Batley College in Dewsbury, and was fortunate to be taught there by a very renowned ceramic artist called David Roberts, who specialises in raku firing. But his work is really, he's exploring drawing, but he's using smoke and firing on the surface of clay to explore mark making and drawing in these beautifully hand-built vessels. And he was a very like straight talking Yorkshireman. So it's quite exciting to sort of have a character like that making these incredibly lyrical, poetic, beautiful works. And I guess that really, sparked my interest in clay as a material. And I was encouraged by David to apply to Edinburgh College of Arts. And that's where I studied ceramics in the design school. But the design, although the department was part of the design school, geographically within the college building, it was actually located more in the sort of visual arts, fine arts section of the college. So we were located next door to the sculpture department. And I think that probably impacted on the type of teaching that we received. And so we were encouraged to be incredibly experimental and explore the material. So you had a really broad spectrum of work happening in the department, from people who were exploring, production throwing, right through to people who were firing nappies in their kind of saga kilns to see what impact that would have on the surface of the clay and the glazes. So it was very broad, and I think that, that was probably a good home for me. But I didn't always love clay. I was a bit sort of torn about it as a material, and didn't always enjoy the unpredictability, and it took me a while to sort of find a way of working with the material, and drawing has really been the sort of key in clay as a surface for drawing and mark making. So that's kind of, yeah, how I got started.
And what's your work now? Can you describe for the listeners sort of the work that you're making currently?
Yeah, so they're ceramic objects that explore languages of ornament and pattern. So they're very detailed, brightly coloured, sort of jewel-like, gem-like, very ornate. They'll have the pieces will be familiar because I'm working with motifs and patterns from different cultures and periods in history. But I'll rework them and I'll juxtapose things from different periods of time or different genres. So there's a kind of curiosity to them as well. And they kind of sit within a domestic scale, but some of the works can be quite large scale, and I also sort of branch out into more architectural scale works, making sort of tile panels or details that will be inserted into interiors. And so work that's sited and place specific and developed through research into a place is kind of all part and parcel of what I do. So I kind of like moving around between scales and moving around between contexts as well. So maybe my preference is to work on sited projects rather than in galleries, but I do have a studio practice and I am making sort of self-contained ceramic objects as well. But all the work comes from research. It all starts from research into decorative art and languages of ornament.
So what elements of the history, I suppose, and the places do really sort of speak to you? What are you looking for when you're researching historical processes or patterns?
Recently I've become incredibly obsessed with Victorian decorative art, and in particular a book called The Grammar of Ornament by an architect and designer called Owen Jones. And it's been a book that's been with me since I was a child, but over the last sort of 5 years I've started to make work directly in response to it. And it's a compendium of pattern from around the world, and it's constructed from an empirical point of view, so it's very much a book of its time, and it you know speaks very much to British design history and I guess our political history and social history. It's a beautiful, beautiful book, and so my initial interest was just in that, in these gorgeous lithographic printed pages that are full of detail and colour and samples of pattern. But as time has gone on, you know, my understanding of the historical context of the book is coming more and more to the fore, and particularly over the last year, really starting to address that and grapple with that, and the deep problems within it are, you know, something that I'm really having to think about now. But it's a hugely influential book, and has played a massive part in, you know, British design culture. So that's been a real focus. And then I guess, you know, jumping off from that, if I'm making a work in a public space, then I'll be looking for historical reference points as a starting point. So it could be tiles, it could be, you know, textiles. It really just depends. And then trying to unpack and look at the stories behind those motifs and patterns and colours, but also just kind of reveling in them and really enjoying them and really playing with them as well.
That sounds amazing. Can you think of any sort of examples? I suppose I'm not very familiar with Victorian influenced design. Are there any sort of key maybe pieces of work that you've done that you can describe what the influence was and then how that translated into your work?
Yeah, so a really significant piece of work over the last few years has been a commission for the Royal Edinburgh Hospital, which was commissioned by Edinburgh and Lothian Health Foundation. And it was one of a series of artist commissions for a new hospital building I guess as kind of informal wayfinding and to enhance and improve and humanise the hospital environment. And the hospital specialises in mental health, and I spent quite a bit of time working with the patients, speaking to them about what would make for a positive environment. And I also looked into the history of the building, and I was aware of Craig House Hospital, which was a precursor to the Royal Edinburgh Hospital, and that was a it was a private private asylum, basically, and it was known for having incredibly beautiful interiors, and I couldn't actually physically access the building, but it's very, very well documented on a website called Canmore that looks at historic buildings and monuments in Scotland. So I researched it through that website. I found all these brilliant photographs of the interiors, beautiful plasterwork ceilings, lovely detailed metal grills, embossed wallpapers. You know, it's an extraordinary space. And I came across two tiled stairwells, very, very typically Victorian, moulded, glazed tiles in ochre and teal. And that was a kind of like, you know, golden moment. And I picked up on the decorative motifs and colours in those tiles and used those as a starting point for developing a contemporary tile work that spans the main corridor of the new Royal Edinburgh building. So the process really was about playing with the colours and playing with the motifs and how they repeated and the scale of the motifs. So you sort of walk through this corridor, which has windows all the way down it. And between the windows are these tiled panels, and they change colour. They move through a colour spectrum from sort of ochres and oranges through to turquoise blues right down to a dark teal. So there's a kind of movement through the space. And to make this work, I collaborated with Craven Dunnell Jackfield, who are a tile manufacturers in Shropshire, who were established in, I can't quite remember the date, 1850 something. And they're absolute specialists in Victorian tile manufacturing, work on lots of heritage projects, but also more and more working with contemporary artists. So I use their skills and knowledge to, I guess, update this tradition of Victorian tiled interiors. So that was a real joy to kind of scale up my work and work with this expertise, look through their glaze library, which is like a sweetie shop. And also, you know, I'd sort of pick up a colour, and then Michelle, their kind of glaze expert, would look at it and say, yeah, we can do that. But, you know, what do you want us to tweak it at all? And then she'd go away and come back with some different samples. So, yeah, it's a really, really fantastic collaboration. And the sort of excitement of seeing my designs, originals, which I made in the studio, then scaled up and you know, multiples in all different departments through the factory was a really exciting moment. So I guess that the end work then is embedded in the history of the building, in dialogue with the patients and staff, and also in the production methods, manufacturing methods as well.
Yeah. Did you use sort of traditional Victorian manufacturing methods and materials, or were they updated at all?
So I guess the thing with ceramics is there's sort of in many ways there's not much that's changed, you know, with the material and how you work with it. So the pieces were slip cast, so there were plaster molds, and liquid clay is poured into plaster molds, and that's a technique that's been, you know, used for a very, very long time. I think maybe the clay body's been tweaked slightly so that it's doesn't warp, and that, you know, they'll be different, but I would imagine pretty much the techniques are the same, you know, as they were back when the factory was first established. So I guess it's, yeah, that's really nice to know that there's that kind of link.
Mm-hmm. And I've had other experts on the podcast talking about not exactly glazes, actually, but sort of enamels and pigments, really, sort of natural pigments. Yeah. Were the colours that you chose based on sort of traditional pigment sources, or were they, again, were they sort of updated for the modern day?
So there would be a mixture of oxides and stains, and most of the colours that we use, I think, were from oxides, because with stains you tend to get a bit of a flatter kind of colour, and maybe something that's not quite so translucent and vibrant. But that, you see, this is where I let myself down, because I don't, I'm not very good at researching my materials.
Okay, interesting.
So that, yeah, that maybe doesn't help with your podcast.
No. It's absolutely fine. I feel like you're maybe, yeah, you're coming at this from a higher level, right? Like, you've got the vision, the artistic vision, and actually the materials don't really matter.
I think it's a question, though, and again, something that I'm probably very late to this, but you know, ethical sourcing of materials is definitely a consideration now. And I've been fortunate enough to be awarded a Queen Elizabeth Scholarship Trust grant to go and spend some time with Craven Dunnell Jackfield on the factory floor.
Oh, cool.
And so I think some of those questions will start to come up when I'm working with them, and starting to look at sort of the origins of the clay that I'm using. And because, I mean, ceramics is pretty unsustainable in one way, as well, in lots of ways, as a means of working. But I guess the one thing that it does have on its side is longevity. So you know, the tiles that are going up on the walls could potentially be there longer than the building.
Yeah. Yeah.
Construction method. So that's the one thing that the material does have on its side in terms of sustainability. But I think being more conscious of the sourcing of the oxides and stains that I'm using, and will be something that will come up through conversations with Craven Dunnell Jackfield.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Why do you say that ceramics are in general quite unsustainable?
Well, I guess you're mining materials, so there are environmental concerns around that. You're firing materials, so there's, you know, an energy cost there. You're potentially polluting the environment with the, you know, the things that are burning off the materials.
Yeah.
And it's just me making work in my studio. You know, I'm not a huge big factory, but nonetheless, I think these are, you know, these are all issues that we need to kind of grapple with at whatever scale we can. So I'm thinking about it. I haven't acted on it as yet.
The sustainability of materials question is so, it's so complex, and it's been very interesting and equally frustrating as a materials scientist in the last 5-10 years. With the public conversation about sustainability of objects and materials, specifically plastics, has been a huge one in the public consciousness. And the complexity of the question about what's the most sustainable material to use for, let's say, a straw or a plastic bag, it's so multifaceted, and even the expert scientists can't, they can only give you an estimate, because it's all tied into you know, human whimsy and what we prefer and what we will accept in terms of material performance and perception. Public perception is kind of one of the biggest driving factors in terms of material choices, not necessarily the sort of the objective facts about the longevity of the materials or the potential for biodegradation or the mining, where they've come from. So it's so complicated. And with ceramics, there's certainly an argument that, like you say, their longevity is incredible, but it is, the firing process is a one-way transition. You know, you're creating ceramic out of clay.
And when you look back at, you know, the history of the potteries in Stoke-on-Trent, I mean, the, you know, the environmental damage and the human cost as well, to that, you know, heavy industrialized manufacturing, you know, and all of that now is we don't think about it anymore, because everything's getting manufactured overseas, so it's not sort of right in front of us anymore. I've not traveled to China to go to any of the ceramic centers there, but yeah, it's sort of out of sight, out of mind, I think, rather than, you know, something. So it is very complicated. And I guess as somebody who's making and contributing to the mountain of objects that, you know, are populating the world, it's a huge question. Yeah. It's kind of overwhelming, really. Sure. But I suppose the fact that I'm doing it at a sort of human scale, I guess, is the one thing that I sometimes think will cling on to a bit, you know, is that it's me in my studio and not a, you know, a great big factory producing things for IKEA, you know, and they're objects that people really, you know, I'm investing time in them, and then people invest in that time, and they become heirloom pieces. So that kind of, I think, guess fewer better things is the sort of mantra that I hold on to justify still making anything at all.
I mean, I think that's a very healthy ethos to have, and even to be thinking about these questions at all puts you ahead of a lot of people making objects in the world, I think. To be mindful of, like you say, this mounting production and consumption.
And I think consumption's the thing as well, and how and what people consume. And also, you know, there's so much more to just sort of making the work, the engagement with people toward making the work and what that can open up. So the studio that I work in, there's a fantastic and growing ceramic education facility called Edinburgh Ceramic Workshop. And it's one of many, you know, around the country now. And there's been this huge resurgence of interest in ceramics, and I think the fact that people would choose to spend a Saturday morning in a pottery studio rather than on the high street purchasing something, you know, is a really positive direction of travel.
Definitely.
And I think people re-engaging with making and how things are made is an incredibly important process, bit of education, opening up of a dialogue to start thinking about how things are made and what we do with them.
Yeah.
And I think if you have a material, an understanding of a material and the process of making, then you can apply that in all sorts of different contexts. So if you understand how the time and expertise and skill involved in throwing a bowl, then that might open up your thinking to how a car is made or how a garment is made or all the, you know, all the different things around us. And I think that sort of divorce from making that's happened in our society contributes to the problem.
Definitely. It'd be really interesting to hear sort of what's next for you. What projects are you working on now? What are the unanswered questions for you in terms of where you want to see your work going?
So as I say, the Quest Scholarship is pending.
Oh, yes.
And that's, that's been a fantastic opportunity that's been delayed slightly by COVID, but I'm hopefully working towards starting up sort of early summer down on the factory floor, getting to grips with all the fabulous making techniques. And you know, I'm a real believer in understanding, as I've just kind of, been on my soapbox about, but in understanding processes and understanding making, and then that can really inform what you do and with this knowledge and with these techniques. So I'm hoping that I can use that information to start working on larger scale ceramic interiors, whether that be with architects or with interior designers or working on further, you know, public projects. I like the idea of bringing that knowledge into my studio practice. So there might be, you know, ways in which I can clad objects, sculptural forms in tiles or units of ceramic, or so that's sort of one direction of travel. I'm also at the moment working on a really exciting new collaboration with a precious stone carving workshop in Jaipur.
Cool.
And I guess that's come out of lockdown really, and the ways in which we've made all these random connections online because we've all been sort of stuck at home. So I made this connection with a company called Kuravinda, and the stone carving workshop is a very long-standing, you know, generations long workshop, but this company is newly establishing, and we're working on some objects that we're going to try and sell to people in the UK. And we're taking some of my designs and inlaying them with precious stones in beautiful marbles and agates and citrines. And
wow.
So it's a new kind of material to work with, but it's very exciting for me because it's taking my interest in languages of ornament from India, which I've been looking at filtered through the grammar of ornament. And I'm now in direct conversation with craftspeople and makers in India, so it's moving that exploration forward, and it's a direct dialogue now, and I'm looking at historical examples from Mughal era India as a reference point for developing contemporary designs. So that's been a really exciting project to work on, and I've just had some samples back of some of the first designs.
Cool.
And it's extraordinary to see, you know, the stones that the Mastercrafts people have selected and how they're translating my drawings. So it's kind of that idea of languages of ornament and them evolving and changing through materials and making and through the hands of different craftspeople. It's actually, you know, a kind of live dialogue, which is really exciting.
That sounds incredible. I can't wait to watch how it develops.
It's all under wraps at the moment. Okay. But yeah, I can't wait to start sharing images of what's going on.
Fantastic.
Maybe sort of in September, we're hoping at the moment. But it's very, you know, it's incredibly challenging at the moment. And, you know, India's gone into lockdown again at the moment.
Yeah.
So it's extraordinary, actually, that the workshop's still, you know, people are still have been able to make things. So that it's also, I guess, it's really, you know, you see news reports of what's happening in India, but then you're actually sort of working directly with somebody who's experiencing that at first hand. And it's been, yeah, really worrying. And
sort
of how lucky we are, actually.
Definitely. But what a special thing to be able to collaborate across borders this year.
Absolutely. Yeah, massively. Armchair travelling.
Yeah, definitely. Oh, fantastic. Well, so I suppose I've got two final questions for you. The first is, you mentioned about, you know, members of the public going to throw pots on a potter's wheel instead of going to the high street on a Saturday.
Yes.
If listeners have been inspired by what you've been saying about sustainability of materials or ceramics in general, well, what would you recommend to the complete beginner in terms of where they can go and learn more?
Yeah, I would go and sign up for a course, definitely. And there's loads of pottery studios establishing themselves. There's been a real resurgence in interest in ceramics. Probably the pottery throwdown has had a huge part to play in that, which is great. So go and sign up for a course, and be prepared to be hugely disappointed with the results, but really enjoy the process.
I could definitely relate to that based on my experiences on the wheel.
Maybe actually try and work in a studio where it isn't just about throwing, but they have the opportunity to show you lots of different techniques. I work predominantly with hand building techniques and using plaster molds, and actually there's, you know, probably in lots of ways that's an easier place to start. Throwing is incredibly difficult.
Yep.
To do so. And in terms of thinking about sustainability of materials, well, here in Scotland, we have Crafts Scotland, and there's the Crafts Council, and both of those organisations are definitely looking at those areas. And Crafts Magazine is a really good publication for, you know, looking at artists who are addressing those issues. So there are lots of artists now who are grappling directly with those and those questions, so that, yeah, hunt those people down, which is what I'm going to be doing, and see what's being made. And
yeah,
I guess asking, we've all got to start asking questions, haven't we? You know, so going to suppliers and saying, well, where is this coming from? What's the environmental impact? And and being careful with materials as well, and, you know, recycling your clay, the clay that doesn't get fired, you know, making sure that you recycle and reuse that, and not wasting materials, being careful with them, being conscious of making sure that your kiln is properly stacked and full, so that you're getting the most out of your firing. All of those sorts of things,
yeah,
I guess.
Great advice. And finally, if listeners have enjoyed hearing from you and want to have a look at your work and keep up to date with what you're up to, where can they go, maybe online, to see what you're doing?
Sure. So I've got a very active Instagram account. So it's Francis Priest Studio, and it's Francis with an E. And I also have a website, but I'm maybe not as good at keeping that up to date. I keep promising to redo my website, and then another 6 months go by. So you can look at sort of an archive of images there, but Instagram's probably, the best place to kind of keep up with what's going on in the studio day to day.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for talking to me today. It's been fascinating to hear from you and about languages of ornament, you know, and your sort of ethos and thoughts behind it.
It's a real pleasure to chat to you. Thanks for inviting me.
So that was the wonderful Frances Priest on all things ceramics. Thanks so much to her for coming on the podcast. A reminder that my book, Handmade, A Scientist's Search for Meaning Through Making, is out now. It's available to order as a hardback online and also available in all good bookshops. And you can get hold of a Kindle copy, if that's more your thing, and the audiobook version online as well. Let me know what you think of the book, if you're enjoying it, or just say hi to me on social media. I'm at Anna Pajaisky. That's everything for this episode. As always, it would be awesome if you could like and subscribe to the podcast and rate and review us on Apple Podcasts too. You can say hello to us on social media. We're on Twitter at Real Talk, that's R-I-A-L Talk, and on Instagram at Handmade Pod. If you feel like supporting the podcast with a one-time financial donation, you can do so at supporter.acast.com/handmade. Thanks to everyone who's already done so. It really does help to keep us going. And a huge thanks as well to Alex Lathbridge for the music mix. Next week, I'll be talking to Sophie Cotterill about her craft of weaving. So until then, take very good care, and I'll speak to you next time on Handmade.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Life's better with American Family Insurance, because our home policies help protect your dreams and come with peace of mind. Save up to 25% by bundling home, auto, and life. American Family Insurance. Get a quote, find an agent at amfam.com.
Products not available in every state. Discounts may not apply to all coverages on an auto or home policy. Discounts do not apply to life insurance policies. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies, American Family Life Insurance Company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.